Alexander has covered American politics, civic life, and the millennial vote since the 2008 presidential campaign. His work has been profiled in news and media ranging from the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times to HuffPost Live and the BBC. His essays, reviews, and op-eds have appeared in Fortune, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Boston Globe, and many other publications. He has lectured and moderated panels at colleges and universities across the country, including Purdue University, Michigan State, University of Nebraska, George Washington University, and Bryn Mawr College. A rising star in the journalism field, Alexander will share with us his experience and expertise as a civic educator to help us promote College Debate 16. Please join me in welcoming the host of The Open Mind on PBS, Alexander Hafner.
Thanks to you all. I really appreciate the energy with which you participated in the earlier sessions, which I heard a little bit of, the Secretary of State. I have some remarks here, but I want to begin by underscoring to you what I think is beautiful about what you've undertaken here, which is the democratization of not just media, but civic life, in taking your values from your communities locally and extrapolating from them to join with your peers, your colleagues, your contemporaries. It's really a magical thing and has the power to influence our democracy, our republic, and the future of our country in a really pro-social way. And I'm going to talk about what I mean by pro-social in a moment, but I want to dovetail based on something that the Secretary of State said. He asked you all, and it was a rhetorical question that he answered emphatically yes. He was really gung-ho about his own work to encourage voters. And I think there was an affirmative recognition through nods that I saw here that there was something inherently nonpartisan or bipartisan in what he was elaborating on, this idea that to get out the vote is not a Democratic or Republican value. It's not liberal or conservative. I don't dispute the Secretary of State's comment, but I want you to recognize that it's about informing communities, because there can't be active citizenship in the way that perpetuates our democracy unless it's informed citizenship. And so I come at this as, yes, a civic educator and a broadcaster and the host of a public television show that you can watch back home. You could also watch it online on pbs.org. But I pay homage in opening my remarks to the former dean of Columbia College, Barnard School specifically, who said, keep an open mind, but not so open that your brains fall out. And that really is the thrust of what I'm going to present today, fact versus fiction, on the future of civil discourse. So I come from the thesis, from the starting point, that in order to secure a fact-based future, we have to salvage civility. And I think you understood that, and I hope you got something out of the documentarian and her presentation. And also, I think both talks this morning highlighted the value of civility. I'm not arguing against the good humor and sometimes even the biting satire that informs young people, millennials specifically, or Gen Zers. I don't know how you define yourselves. If I'm a millennial, I'm really an old fogey outlier millennial in that I came of age with Encyclopedia Britannica, going to the library and not Googling for an answer, and that became a component of my education, but was not the dominant force. But I want us together to reimagine the idea of civility, making civility sexy in the context of that fact-based future. How we can discern the truth, not just through a metric of politifact, this is right or pants on fire wrong, but through honoring our brothers and sisters as the people with whom we share and inhabit this American democracy. And really, whether you're reporting on the campaign, as I did starting in high school and college, collecting the student voice in a project that I did called Scoop 08, which was the 2008 presidential campaign. At the time, I was a graduating senior in high school, then going on to college, and collecting young people's reporting and voices was the mission of the organization that I started with a friend at Yale. And we together reimagined what force journalism could play, student and citizen journalism, around that common goal of an informed community. So that's the essential goal that I want us to focus on today. I think about that word civilization and civility, and I think, well, what is the origin of that? It is really, we want to be a force for good in anything that we do, if we're going to contribute to this great experiment that is American democracy. How do we do that and still survive and accommodate differences of opinion? That really is a critical question in this election, when you have one side of the fence that lives on Mars and one lives on Venus. And they used to say that about men and women. And to some extent, that's true, because the Democratic Party more embraces the vocabulary and the policy positions of women, specifically younger women, who've become the base of the Democratic Party. But really, Republicans and Democrats have occupied two sets of languages that are opposite. And so how can civility even coexist with those differences of opinion? Well, I would theorize, postulate, and open with this idea that this 2016 campaign has been a demonstration of everything that's uncivil. And I gave a talk recently at the University of San Diego, and it was called Incivility and Its Discontents. And that, to me, synopsizes acutely the problems of our discourse today, and how you collectively can not only be a voice for policy proposals that are going to fix our democracy, but can start a new footing in how we embrace language for the better. And that hasn't been what we've been exposed to. We've seen hate mongering, racism, xenophobia, and a whole series of toxic moments that define to date what this 2016 campaign is about. So debating 2016 actively in an informed way is your responsibility, and grasping the facts and ensuring that they are the underlying basis of how you argue, debate with your friends, and ultimately vote on election day. And we still have a primary here in California and a couple of subsequent contests. That is going to depend on all of you. So it's not all about your votes. And I do dispute the notion, even as an ardent advocate of civic engagement, and for whoever asked the question about digital voting, I am right there with you, because that's the first question that ought to be asked to the Secretary of State. But even with those digital reinforcements, if you will, you're going to have a hard time salvaging, and I use that word again, but really preserving the core of our democracy if we don't have a fundamental truth that is beyond our partisan affiliation, our ideological identity, and our skin color, and our race, and our ethnicity. And when you hear not just the hate that's been directed at immigrants, Mexicans, Muslims, and women, you think of the truncation of information. There's Lion Cruz, there's Crooked Hillary, and that being the way that we are underpinning, that being the fabric that is tearing us apart, we can do better. Why is incivility rampant or seemingly? I cover the 2008 campaign. I can tell you that the image being projected of our country in terms of the well-being and the quality of our discourse and our understanding and our ability to compromise, it is a vastly different universe. Yes, President Obama is more liberal than other candidates who've emerged since he was elected. Yes, he has a political identity. But in 2008, there was a very important moment that journalists took hold of, and that was when, at a McCain event, and John McCain, the senior senator from Arizona, running against the junior senator from Chicago, Illinois, and it was when a Trump-like voter insisted at a campaign event for Senator McCain that the president was not a loyal citizen, he was a Muslim, or that he was a terrorist. And in fewer than any tweet, you know, the characters of a tweet, McCain said no. And he said no emphatically, and he said he's an honorable family man. And if you contrast that with the way that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are emerging as the front runners of their respective parties this cycle, it is a world of difference. One element that can be static is your participation, because in 2008, President Obama had a dominant, not just a net roots operation, but a dominant strategy to win over disenchanted young people. And whether or not it's Clinton or Trump or a third party candidate who is able to channel that energy in a positive way, that is to be determined, and I think it's to be determined by many people in your age cohort. So I was asking, why is the incivility rampant? Well, one thing is, folks in my profession are not willing to take ownership of some of the realities that I've acknowledged from the outset here today. And that is that there's been a vast media conglomerate profiteering off of the kinds of vitriol that have been expressed and that have been given an endless microphone in this cycle. So news coverage has become this, not a blurring line, it is entirely the thread infotainment, not information. And we at public television, and I think there are some really terrific people in commercial broadcast and print as well, some of whom use discretion about what constitutes a lead and a headline and a story, but we've seen a insatiable appetite for our news and our political news specifically as a way that clickbait, when you click, you like, you comment. I was glad that the dean is awarding a prize for dialogue as well as volume of likes, because that really is an inherent problem in the current media landscape. So the problem of incivility begins when the chairman of CBS, bless his heart, says that Donald Trump may be dangerous for America, but he's good for our company. He's good for ratings. That's a direct quote. I was on the street in San Diego about a month ago, and I saw a young woman with a shirt that said, "Me? Wrong? Never." I went online and Googled it, and I found it's a real shirt. You can buy it. And to me, it translated seamlessly into this Trump phenomenon. It is the exploitation of celebrity, but it's the exploitation of ego, and underlying that demonstrably is a focus on status and symbolism. Again, Lion Ted, Crooked Hillary. I'm not for a moment disillusioning you from the reality that democracy is messy. But in order to forge consensus and to live on that single planet of either Mars or Venus, we have to talk in a way that is going to lead us to be pro-social rather than anti-social. And I think it epitomizes what political reporters find in the electorate, which is this kind of, if any of you are students of political science, the gerrymandering concept. Yes, I know the Secretary of State talked about it. The gerrymandering is not just in our congressional districts. It's the way that we dice up media into left and right, MSNBC and Fox News. Now, again, there are commentators, there are journalists, there are pundits who are hardworking and sometimes providing creative analysis that our democracy demands, but a lot of times it is an echo chamber of left and right. And so as the host of a program called The Open Mind, the imperative from 1956 on has been free to expand, you know, your idea, free to examine, free to disagree, and free to question. And so that really is, I think, the most imperative thing that you as young voters, as well as journalists potentially, can be engaged in. A free flow of information that is questioning the way the news is covered, the way, not just the way candidates are advertising themselves, but a real interrogation of the ideas in our media, in our journalism, and of course in our candidates. Incivility in the context that I'm describing of these two separate planets leads not just to this idea of an incivility of bigotry, but it leads to the idea of an incivility of obstructionism. Because all you have to do is look at President Obama's Supreme Court nominee, whom the Republicans refused to give a hearing, to know that there's something wrong in our politics. A fair hearing is not the same as even an up or down vote. It is just part of a deliberative democracy that judges people on the basis of virtue, on the basis of merit, on the basis, in the case of Merrick Garland, on the most experienced candidate for the Supreme Court in the history of the institution of the Supreme Court. So it's my thesis that the kind of incivility of bigotry leads to these alien communities of left and right, and that obstructs not just the discourse, but the ability to do policy making. And that's what the Secretary of State said. You are the future, today, in the present. In order to operate in that from a journalistic or media lens, in the way that you see the coverage play out, whether it's the New York Times covering Donald Trump once, twice, three times, the entire week, front page story, in a way that is not, now they're starting to get the picture. Look at the New York Times the last two or three days. You saw stories that were really investigative exposés, that are doing due diligence, that are doing reporting, that are doing the interrogation. And prior to those few days, you had a story about Hillary Clinton that was quite skeptical from the lens of a reporter who was probing for the truth. So it cuts both ways. But there's no doubt that this obstructionism is the incivility that is preventing you from talking to your neighbors, not just sitting here today, but really back home, the kind of toxicity in our politics that is so dominant. I talked about the antisocial behavior. What I try to do on my program, The Open Mind on PBS, is to facilitate an environment in which it is not interrogating the person, it's interrogating the idea. And therefore, you're disarming and you're freeing from their ideological shackles candidates, dignitaries, observers of politics, whether they're academics or clinicians, practitioners in the field. You're freeing them of those talking points. And I think that it's incumbent upon all of you to realize that we can transcend talking points. And this is not a partisan issue. If you want to have an informed citizenry, you need to transcend talking points. What are talking points? They're the 2 to 3 minutes, really now 20 to 30 seconds, that a particular candidate, again, candidate, pundit, observer gets when he's on or she's on television, or these days when a reporter is asking for you to comment, it's the paragraph or sentence that will appear in the newspaper and then in an even more truncated form tweeted down to 140 characters. So the antisocial behavior, I don't just see as discourse. I see it in the reporting that I've done over the last four, five, six, couple of election cycles. It is the kind of, there's a duality. There are two things happening at the same time. It's the dumbing down of the discourse, but it's also the practical reality of a dwindling middle class. And that's really the way that Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, who was on my program too, before he declared his candidacy, too is in some of the other figures I refer to, not Donald Trump. But the idea that we're dumbing down the discourse at the same time that we're devaluing our currency and the bank accounts of middle class Americans, that is an equation that can be quite lethal. And to me, the disenfranchisement of the discourse and the people who were participating in the discourse leads people to absolute rage rather than reason. And so I see those phenomena as interlinked. Effectively, an American oligarchy that is governed from the bottom up, there is the lowest common denominator of discourse. So where does that incivility lead us? So we talked about the incivility of bigotry leading to a kind of incivility of obstructionism, leading to what I deem, and I hope you all will challenge me on this because folks have challenged me on this, an incivility of political correctness. And by that I don't at all mean, and I'm speaking from the public television perspective and public media perspective, I don't mean a tolerance for bigotry of any kind. I don't mean to confuse political incorrectness with the kind of vicious attacks on people because of the way they look or the gender they are. I mean that our politics are wrong. They're not correct. I mean, we're constantly striving for that more perfect union. But it is this acceptance of a PC culture in the discourse. Like, it's a kind of status quo with which we view the issues. And it is in that polarized lens that politically incorrect is, if you're a Democrat, you have to say one thing to win that gerrymandered progressive district. If you're a Republican in, say, Trump country or Ryan country in Wisconsin, you have to say something else, right? I think the point is that that gerrymandering is not a standalone problem as we report it. It is a problem in our language, in our discourse, and in the way the media relate things to the American public. So I think the American public, by and large, they're fed up with these half-truths. They want really the picture of why there is this incivility, and not just the incivility of bigotry, and not just the incivility of obstructionism, but that incivility of not having the means to have a livable income today. Because the most uncivil thing of all is that the concentration of wealth is in the hands of very few people. And that's not a Democratic talking point or a Republican talking point. That is the reality that populists, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, have fed off this cycle. It is, I wouldn't call it concentration of wealth or deconcentration of wealth as much as what I've reported on, and when I have folks on the show to talk about public policy challenges, the myriad of questions derive from the reality being that there has been an economic marginalization, disempowerment, that is reminiscent of the kind of segregation that we lived with 50 years ago. So I don't, and I think it's what's so problematic about the way affirmative action as a policy has been sold to the American people, because it was always on the basis of race and not on the basis of income. There is a much more appealing argument to be made that it is a race blind democratization that considers people's welfare and lifting their welfare up. And whether you're a Democrat or Republican, whether you were Jeb Bush on the campaign trail, as I was in New Hampshire months ago, or you're Donald Trump, who's on the populist wing of the Republican Party, or you're Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, the issue of this election is inequality. But the reality is we live in the dichotomized left-right world where the solutions to that inequality diverge completely, and they're not even reported on in the same sentence, because again, you can't have one planet with a New York Times and a Wall Street Journal. They used to coexist. So I want to close by acknowledging, like I said before, we can't reason with the rage and the deep-seated resentments. We can try to heal some of the wounds. And we can try to replace, we collectively can try to replace the visceral politics of negativity with the capacity to take a deep breath. And I know a lot of you are not reading your smartphones right now, and I really appreciate that as a public speaker who does this as an extension of my show quite often with millennial communities. And I know that's because you're engaged, you applied to be here, and you are motivated to be part of that solution. So hear me out when I say that you all should be imploring your classmates in college and your younger and older siblings to think. Think about the challenges that face us and the kind of climate that we want to induce or engender in encouraging our peers, our brethren, to speak honestly and openly, but in a way that makes people motivated to further that. You know, there's a lot of discussion of safe communities that you probably get emails from administrators at your schools about. Well, we don't have a safe politics right now, and we want to embrace an alternative to that. And unlike a lot of journalists who couldn't come out here and say that, when you do have your own program with the mandate of civic education that is harmonious with the goals and aspirations of this program, then I can say that. And I don't realize, I don't understand why, and all of the reporters, correspondents, chroniclers of our politics in the broader media landscape can't take ownership or acknowledgement of the facts that I'm presenting to you today. So I think we need to understand that a dangerously visceral politics is leading to a tipping point that could be of no return. But the question of this election is not who's more liberal or conservative, it's who's more civil. And think of all the resolutions that you've ever made with your classmates. Resolutions are the forefront of governing, and it's what we cover in the media, and then we dissect what negotiations, diplomacy, and understandings led to the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the Endangered Species Act, and other. Now, you can have problems with pieces of legislation, but they also led to freeing Soviet influence from communism, which is not a liberal or progressive talking point. That more sounds like a conservative talking point. It also led to the decisions and the consultation, and I, when you finish up here today, read Hillary Clinton's speech today and do share it with your colleagues, and I'm eager to hear what you all think, but she imagined Donald Trump in the Situation Room on the eve of the bin Laden raid. So those decisions are made, as President Obama himself says, and every living president, Carter, Bush, the other, H.W. Bush, Clinton, the decisions don't get to the president's desk if they're easy. The decision to elect a president is the voter's opportunity for the one most salient opportunity to do something at the level of that president. And we should take it seriously, and we should think about the kind of constructive force young people and the broader electorate want to play. I want to close now by thinking a bit about the future of civility in the media and in the context of this whole fact versus fiction. I think we have to be able to disagreeably agree within reason. That's the starting point of being able to compromise. I don't mean disagreeably as in fists out, but I mean there are going to be disagreements and you have to forge consensus. That's the only way a democracy can operate. You have to challenge the status quo. You have to embrace the possibility of differing perspectives, if you want to call that controversy, but not for the sake of controversy. And that's where I think galvanizing communities around social media is, as your earlier speaker said, critically important. And I completely embrace everything she said, including that Snapchats don't disappear. But she used a lot of terms in the legal context, but I'm using it in the civic context of, yes, you want to charge your democracy, but we want to figure out a way that something can go viral and still comport with your values. And that's a hard thing to do today. Controversy for controversy's sake, are those tweets and Snapchats and theses that you put out in social media that are not necessarily thoughtful, but they're just intentionally clickbait. I think you ought to contemplate the radical revamp of education that is possible in the 21st century. I don't know how many of you follow public television, but there's a series, Finding Your Roots, where celebrities have taken swabs of DNA, and then the study comes back and shows how they're part of the American story, the American heritage, the American experience. That should be in every public school classroom. You all have the advantage of being motivated young people today, and for whatever reason, wanted to come here to contribute to the solution, but a lot of your peers are listless in the winds, and something like that, in addition to robust conversation, dialogue, debate, could really amplify the effect and inform participation in government because it is part of that joint collective heritage. I think we need to examine the place of faith in public education, because there are a lot of, I know you come from many diverse schools, including, I'm sure, some schools where the communities, the constituencies and families are believers, people of faith. And I want to mention this only insofar as I think that one of the chasms that's so sore, that's so embittered in that divide of Mars and Venus, or whatever planets you want to use, is this idea that there are no people of faith welcome into public education, that decisions are going to be made on a basis of what's secular morality. I've been in public school, private school, universities, been exposed to a lot of universities, and I think that the place of faith is an important one, and to embrace all people is not just the debate we're having about transgender communities now, but to underscore to people, when you talk about the incivility of bigotry, you mean the neo-Nazis, but you also mean people who are not tolerant of our citizens of faith. I encourage you to pick up a few books. One is by an academic, The Politics of Resentment, Rural Consciousness in Wisconsin. And it's a really good play-by-play of how this political scientist discovered the seeds, the origin of that resentment in the rural and urban chasm that so infuses a lot of the hate in our politics. The other book is more appropriate in my journalistic context, and that is The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less. And that is the idea that when you can Wikipedia an answer, within seconds have it, is that understanding? Is that even knowing? And that question is going to determine the outcome of this election and how young people galvanize around the answer to that question. What is the difference between knowing and understanding, and why is it important in the perpetuation, persevering through a democracy? Again, it's a messy proposition, but forging consensus, underlying that consensus, has to be fact.
You said it's knowing more and understanding more.
Yeah. The first book is The Politics of Resentment, Rural Consciousness in Wisconsin. You can look at The Open Mind and see my interview with Michael Lynch, the academic at the University of Connecticut who wrote The Internet of Us, and Kathleen Kramer is coming up on my show this summer. She's the author of The Politics of Resentment. But the question that Michael explores is this idea of how can we facilitate a virtual and a non-virtual meeting of the minds. I guess I'll close by saying, you know, how you dissect this media environment is important. You should imagine, when I say reimagine civility, you should think about how the golden rules, whether you taught them in grade school or by family or friends, how they apply to what you do, not just in the voting booth, but how you communicate on social media. I had the founder of Twitter on my show and asked him, why don't you import a civic virtue in what you're doing to ensure that people are tweeting as responsibly as they're voting or thinking about democracy? And it concerned him that in reality there's no import or value inherent in these social media to be pro-social. And we have to really take it upon ourselves as journalists, as citizens, to do that. And you know, I want to answer some questions, and one of them might pertain to the controversy surrounding Facebook and the idea that they were curating on the basis of what they viewed as important or legitimate news information, which somehow offended people. Well, if Twitter and Facebook are conceding any kind of moral high ground that they could impart, and I'm not saying vote Clinton or vote Trump, then isn't that an abdication of the highest order? Isn't that troubling? To me, when a Senate committee can bully you around based on independent decision making around what stories are important, that doesn't sound like the free press. That sounds like the same idea that conservatives have bashed for a long time of the problems associated with the fairness doctrine, when you have to give one candidate exactly as much time as another on the air in any news story, which would be impossible today because of the internet. So it was never a practical policy that could be retained. But I urge you all to not just keep an open mind, which is what I say at the end of every show, but to think about how you live in this more expansive media environment, because whether it's the platform you're on, whether it's Firefox or Safari, the browser you're using, the e-commerce sites that you're visiting online, Amazon, eBay, whatever, or the dialogues that you're having with your peers, those all have a digital footprint that either can be analogous to the values that you hold dear and to the values of this country, or that can be in opposition to those values. I appreciate your time, and I'm very happy to answer any questions. Yes?
With this absolute insane presidential circus election we have coming up, I don't know what other way to describe it. I think they're just, what we are not here to do is talk about parties, but talk about the issues. What is it going to take for our government to stop this fighting and start thinking about what is best for our country? I mean, we teach our children not to argue and not to do things like this, and then here we are, we have a presidential election that these people are wanting to rip each other's eyeballs out and saying the meanest things possible and setting the absolute worst example for children that they could possibly set, and nothing, absolutely nothing, is being accomplished. What is it going to take?
Thank you. I tried to be prescriptive at the end of my prepared comments here. I would solicit the opinions of these young people more than mine. And I hope that, and I've said this to the administrators, the leaders of your initiative here, I hope that what eventually results here from a kind of college delegation and convention is a blueprint for the future, that all of you can team up together, and 4 years from now, if you're not satisfied with the politics that have come as a result of the 2016 election, can band together and actually have the mechanics and financial support and political will to have your own convention and your own candidate. Because we have seen a lot of talk and no action. I was on the phone shortly before visiting with you all with the leading plaintiff in a suit against the Commission on Presidential Debates because of their rule that is dictated by poll numbers, and a lot of polls will not include the Libertarian ticket, Johnson Weld. But of course, the filing deadlines for presidential campaigns demand not only a lot of money and paperwork completed, but a candidate. And there's been a huge dereliction of duty and cowardice on the part of people who, you know, are actors in politics and criticize the unfavorability or unpopularity of the candidates and refuse to put a candidate up of their own. And so there's been a lot of talk and not a lot of action. You can be part of the action in developing the infrastructure that can build a campaign. I did it as a journalist. Scoop 08 was just a blog. And then we got dozens of young people to write for it in late 07 into the 08 campaign. CNN invited us to be regular contributors. We got picked up by major news organizations, and it led to a lot of high-quality journalism that spoke many more volumes about the sentiment of young people during the 07-08 years than any public opinion polls. And so I would say try to mute out the polls and the horse race and the nasty assaults on people's character and dive into an alternative. Again, the infrastructure we set up was a virtual newsroom dedicated to young people covering the campaign. You can devise a convention and ultimately a presidential ticket if you want, but it starts with developing a consensus. And there are organizations like No Labels and Peter Ackerman, who I mentioned, who's suing the Commission on Presidential Debates, who want to democratize the balloting so that a third-party alternative can be championed. But there is a billion-dollar lobbyist industry on the left and the same on the right, and that middle ground is not as fertile. So for two or three cycles, young people, I would say, channeled their enthusiasm through the campaigns of Barack Obama. In this cycle, young people might not necessarily gravitate towards Hillary Clinton, even though I think ultimately, based on everything we know, a huge portion of young people will vote for her over Donald Trump. But if you're not satisfied with those options and the dysfunctional processes that govern our politics today, then you have to stand up and do it yourselves. And I don't think any mountain, I will not put this in the format of a double negative, I'll say it in a positive way. I'll say every mountain can be conquered here, and you are the people to counter all the malevolent forces and conquer that mountain. Yeah.
So you think that the politics of civility is the best way to go about this. However, you also mentioned the civil rights movement, women's suffrage movement, and in those movements, civil disobedience played a huge part, and civility was not always the way that those movements went about it. Where do you think civil disobedience falls within this spectrum, and what role do you think the media should be playing in that?
Well, I think that you said it in your question. Civil disobedience is civil. I mean, yeah, you want to? She had a follow-up.
I guess the question I'm asking is, within those movements, not all of this disobedience was civil. You know, like you had like the Black Panther movement and other things. So where do you think those roles would play in your politics of civility idea?
Well, again, it's I know that I am touting civility as the modus operandi of the show that I do and the approach that I have. But I think that you all are in a better position to determine whether or not we find our better angels, as Lincoln said, through civility or through some other cause. Now, I asked this question of some students at Wesleyan when they invited me to speak there. Well, what is the opposite of civility? I mean, you know, where do you draw the line in effect if your tactics are less than civil? And so, you know, the whole idea of hacking to, whether it's Snowden or other examples of the kind of thing that we might call civil disobedience in a digital age, where does that fit into it? The questions of national security. I think these are all ideas that can be viewed abstractly, and then they can be viewed through the lens of like a party platform. And right now, those party platforms, with maybe the exception of the libertarians, are beholden to the interests of the left and the right, right? So when I talk about political correctness, I'm not saying that that is a function of a superior approach by left or right. I'm saying it is in our political correctness that we fail to cross the fence ideologically, right? And so in this election, we haven't seen quite the degree of violence that marred some of the politics of hate and fear from the McCarthy era to civil rights, but we've seen some of it. And so if your question is, you know, how do we deal with the protesters at Trump events in this context of 2016 and freedom from fear, but rather freedom to fear in the age of Trump? I mean, I think we ought to deal with it. We ought to use the law. The law is a vehicle to restore not just civility, but you know, the rights of people who have been marginalized. So there would be a place for civil disobedience or disobedience broadly if younger people were more motivated to do things. But the only thing I find applicable to your question is the hacking example, because young people aren't protesting in the streets, with maybe the exception of the climate movement, which is an important one, and the Occupy movement that fizzled out. But I would be able to answer your question a little bit more comprehensively if there was some embodiment of that today that had policy ramifications. Yeah, I think that's true. The issue with Black Lives Matter in terms of galvanizing a broader consciousness and policy framework is that the advocates of criminal justice reform have not developed a platform through which they can stand alone. I mean, we'll see if the Johnson Weld ticket represents that idea. I'm not diminishing the value or relevance of Black Lives Matter. I'm just saying that it hasn't fomented itself through a political platform. And that's exactly what I don't mean to plagiarize from the president, but in other words, that's what he said at one of his commencement speeches. I think it might have been at Rutgers or the one before that. But he said, you have to invite the Black Lives Matter protesters, and they have to be willing to embrace channels of political reform that are not just interrupting people. And that's not all that they do, right? They've done some substantive things in the, you know, both from reporters' perspectives, in the way that, for example, my friend Wesley Lowery of the Washington Post, a 26-year-old, I think he's younger than me, a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, was down there in Ferguson doing incredible work reporting on the movement, and demonstrated the not just uncivil but unlawful conditions there, and that blew him up into a Twitter celebrity, but it didn't blow the issue up into being sort of adjudicated in the court of law and then in the court of constitutional law, that is the U.S. Senate, ultimately the Supreme Court. So in order for that movement to have staying power, it can't be a blip in the radar and just a response to the latest egregious incident of violence. Yeah.
Okay, so you talked a lot about civility, and what I interpret that as is saying, you know, use arguments backed by logic and reason.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's very important. I think another thing that's important to do, especially when you're considering civility, is to have enough respect for yourself that you stand true to your principles, right? So you can have a civil discourse and you know, maintain truth to your principles and not let some sort of you know, attacks move you to a position that isn't true to your character. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I was going to start the presentation, but I decided not to because the other two talks were sort of use this, but what do you think should animate our politics today, right? If you want a fact-based discourse. And I think that we've seen personality dictate our politics more than facts. And what you said about conviction is absolutely right. You know, the foundation of democracy, whether you read the Federalist Papers or the Declaration or Constitution, and any of the biographies that you might read of the founders and founding mothers and fathers, you'd see this idea of humility and conviction in conjunction with each other. And it is humility and conviction working together that I think makes the American experience possible. Yes.
Last one.
Okay, all the way in the back.
Thank you for being here. So everything that you were talking about during your presentation that I was thinking about was Noam Chomsky's recent documentary where he talked about concentration of wealth and power. And one thing that he really focused on was this idea that our system is set up purposefully to curb the excess of democracy. So in a sense, like when you talked about the book Politics of Resentment, this idea of, you know, the fear of the intellectual from, you know, rural areas, for instance, to intellectual shaming of people who might not be to that standard. And so I guess what I'm wondering is that while you're obviously advocating we should use civility and stuff, do you think that the system is purposefully designed for there to be this bickering so that there can be a further concentration of wealth and power among those elites?
No, or do you no think- I think all you have to do is go to the presidential libraries of Roosevelt and Reagan to know that that's a false. I mean, to my mind, I wouldn't be engaged in the journalism that I do if I thought that the system was rigged in effect to deny facts from being facts. I think that it's always a challenge, and that whether it's Chomsky or Oliver Stone or whoever you're reading or watching present an artful case that were a kind of doom and gloom scenario, but that's not the way I see it, and that's not the way I could function having conversations with people on the air in which I am asking them to be their highest selves and to escape systems that they might be attached to and ask them how they can correct those systems. And usually, whether it's on or off camera, there is an acknowledgement of this is what we have to do to correct the system. Now, is that the pervasive wind? No. We're not a solutions-oriented discourse or democracy at the present. But all you have to do is go to one of my favorite places, Hyde Park. How many of you are New Yorkers here or have some roots in New York, to know that when the stakes were high in our country, whether it was World War II or the Great Depression, there were policies being drawn up that were considering the condition of the country and improving the country. And I think you could go to the LBJ Library in Austin and the Reagan Library in Simi Valley and find the same thing, that people were actually working on a system that might have been challenged and infected, but working to it sort of, again, appealed to our higher selves. Thanks.
All right, great conversation, everyone. And I'm going to ask Alex to stick around for just one quick second, because we're going to do a withy, because that's what we do. So if you wouldn't mind coming right here in the center, and you guys do your thing, and then right when we're done with this, we've got a quick activity, okay? So.
All right, here we go. Ready, 1, 2, 3. There we go. All right.
Alexander Hefner, College Convention 2016.